and it's like her body has stopped bothering to tell her how it feels, so she doesn't even have the pain to distract her. She sits and thinks about Sergeant's anger and what it means. It could mean a lot of things, but the starting point is the same in every case. It was only when she talked about Miss Justineau that Sergeant got angry, when she said that Miss Justineau loved her. Melanie understands jealousy. She's jealous, a little bit, every time Miss Justineau talks to another boy or girl in class. She wants Miss Justineau's time to belong to her, and the reminders that it doesn't sting a little, make her heart do a gentle drop and thud in her chest. But the idea of Sergeant being jealous is dizzying. If Sergeant can be jealous, there are limits to his power, and she herself stands at one of those limits, looking back at him. That thought sustains her, for a while. But nobody comes, and the hours drag on, and though she's good at waiting, at doing nothing, the time is hanging heavy on her. She tries to tell herself stories, but they fall apart in her mind. She sets herself simultaneous equation puzzles and solves them. But it's too easy when you've made the problems up yourself. You're halfway to the answer before you've started to think about it properly. She's tired now, but her enforced position in the chair doesn't allow her to rest. Then, after a long, long time, she hears the key turning in the lock, the bolts drawn back, heavy steel door clanging, footsteps running on concrete, raising a whisper farm of echoes. Is it Sergeant? Has he come back to dismantle her? Someone unlocks Melanie's door and pushes it open. Miss Justineau stands in the doorway. It's okay, she says. I'm here, Melanie. I'm here for you. Miss Justineau steps forward. She wrestles with the chair like Hercules wrestling with a lion or a snake. The arm strap is partway undone, and it opens up really easily. Then Miss J goes down on her knees and she's working on the leg straps. Right, then left. She mutters and curses as she works. He's frigging insane. Why? Why would anyone do this? Melanie feels the constriction lessen, and sensation returns to her legs in a tingling rush. She surges to her feet, her heart almost bursting with happiness and relief. Miss Justineau has saved her. She raises her arms in an instinct too strong to resist. She wants Miss Justineau to lift her up. She wants to hold her and be held by her and be touching her, not just with her hair, but with her hands and her face and her whole body. Then she freezes like a statue. Her jaw muscles stiffen and a moan comes out of her mouth. Miss Justineau is alarmed. Melanie? She stands and her hand reaches out. Don't! Melanie screams. Don't touch me! Miss Justineau stops moving, but she's so close. So close! Melanie whimpers. Her whole mind is exploding. She staggers back, but her stiff legs don't work properly and she falls full length on the floor. The smell, the wonderful, terrible smell fills the room and her mind and her thoughts, and all she wants to do is go away, she moans. Go away, go away, go away. Miss Justineau doesn't move. Go away or I'll fucking dismantle you. Melanie wails. She's desperate. Her mouth is filled with thick saliva like mud from a mudslide. Her jaws start to churn of their own accord. Her head feels light and the room sort of goes away and then comes back again without moving. Melanie is dangling on the end of the thinnest, thinnest piece of string. She's going to fall and there's only one direction to fall in. Oh, God! Miss Justineau sobs. She gets it at last. She takes a step back. I'm sorry, Melanie. I didn't even think about the showers. Among the sounds that Melanie heard, one big absence. No hiss of chemical spray falling from the ceiling to settle on Miss Justineau and layer on its own smell to hide the Miss Justineau smell underneath. What Melanie feels right then is what Kenny felt when Sergeant wiped the chemicals off his arm and put it right up close to Kenny's face. But she only just caught the edge of it that time, and she didn't really understand it. Something opens inside her, like a mouth opening wider and wider and wider and screaming all the time, not from fear, but from need. Melanie thinks she has a word for it now, although it still isn't anything she's felt before. It's hunger. When the children eat, hunger doesn't factor into it. The grubs are poured into your bowl and you shovel them into your mouth. But in stories that she's heard, it's different. The people in the stories want and need to eat, and then when they do eat, they fill up with something. It gives them a satisfaction nothing else can give them. Melanie thinks of a song the children learned and sang one time. "You're my bread when I'm hungry." Hunger is bending Melanie's spine like Achilles bending his bow. And Miss Justineau will be her bread.
"You have to go," she says.
She thinks she says. She can't be sure because of the heart sounds and breath sounds and blood sounds that are crashing in her ears. She makes a gesture.
"Go!"
But Miss Justineau is just standing there, trapped between wanting to run and wanting to help. Melanie scrambles up and lunges, arms stretched out. And it's almost like that other gesture, a moment ago, when she asked to be picked up. But now she presses her hands against Miss Justineau's stomach. Touching. Touching. Touching her. And pushes her violently away. She's stronger than she ever guessed. Miss Justineau staggers back, almost trips. If she trips, she'll be dead. Be bread. Melanie's muscles are tensing, knotting, coiling inside her, gathering themselves for some massive effort. She diverts them into a bellowing roar. Miss Justineau scrambles, stumbles, is out through the door and wrenching it closed. Melanie is moving forward and pulling backward at the same time. A man with a big dog on a leash, and she's both of them, straining against the tether of her own will. The first bolt slides home exactly as she hits the door. The smell, the need, fill her from toe to crown, but Miss Justineau is safe on the other side of the door. Melanie claws at it, wondering at her own stupid, hopeful fingers. The door won't open now. But some animal inside her still thinks it might. It's a long time before the animal gives up. And then, exhausted, the little girl sinks to her knees next to the door, rests her forehead against the cold, unyielding concrete. From above her, Miss Justineau's voice.
"I'm sorry, Melanie. I'm so sorry."
She looks up groggily, sees Miss J's face at the mesh window.
"It's all right," she says, weakly. "I won't bite."
It's meant to be a joke. On the other side of the door, Miss Justineau starts to cry. Chapter 11. For a great many reasons, the events of that day will eventually become a soggy, undifferentiated mass in Helen Justineau's mind. But three things will stand out clear for her until the day she dies. The first is that Sergeant Parks was right all along. Right about her, and about the risks that her behaviour has exposed her to. Seeing the child turn into the monster, right before her eyes, has made her understand at last that both are real. There is no future in which she can set Melanie free, or save her, or remove that cell door from between them. The second is that some things become true simply by being spoken. When she said to the little girl, "I'm here for you," The architecture of her mind, her definition of herself, shifted and reconfigured around that statement. She became committed, or maybe just acknowledged a commitment. It has nothing to do with guilt for earlier crimes, although she has a pretty fair understanding of what she deserves, or any hope of redemption. It's just the outermost point on an arc. She's risen as far as she can, and now she's falling again, no longer in control, if she ever was to start with, of her own movements. The deadline that was set for her is coming on at a rush. She's expected to choose which of the class will be disassembled on Caroline Caldwell's table. She has no idea what she'll do now. All her options seem to be barred in one way or another. The third thing is almost banal in comparison. It's just that the movement she saw over Parks's shoulder when he was warning her away from the perimeter was on the wrong side of the fence. That was what had distracted her, thrown her off her stride for a moment after the two of them ricocheted off one another and recoiled. A human figure had been watching the fence from the edge of the woods, almost out of sight among the trees and the waist-high undergrowth. Not a hungry. A hungry wouldn't hold a branch aside with his hand to maintain a clear line of sight. A junker, then. A wild man who never came inside. And therefore, she reasons, not a threat. Because all the threats she's concerned about right now relate to friendly fire. Chapter 12. If Eddie Parks knows one thing, it's that he's sick of this detail. He was okay with the retrieval runs as far as that went. The grab bagging, the soldiers called it. Dirty work and about as dangerous as you can get, but so what? You knew what the risks were going to be and the rewards. You weighed them in your hands and they made sense. You could see why you were doing it. And that was what kept you doing it, week in and week out. Going into areas where you knew damn well there'd be hungries around every corner. The inner cities, where the population density was highest and the infection spread quicker than the fear of it. And your life was on the line with every choice you made, every step you took, because there were all kinds of situations you could walk into and not walk out of. The hungries in the city. Christ fucking Jesus. They're like statues most of the time, because they don't move unless something else moves. You're sprayed from head to foot with E-blocker so they can't smell you, and you can walk right by them as long as you do it slow enough and smooth enough that you don't flip their trigger. You can get yourself in really deep. Then some clumsy bastard trips over a loose paving stone, or sneezes, or just scratches his ass, and one of the hungries whips its head round on the sound or the movement or whatever the hell, and once one of them clocks you, it's monkey see monkey do for all the rest. They go from 0 to 60 in half a heartbeat, and they're all running in the same direction. So then you've got three choices, two of which will reliably get you killed. If you freeze, the hungries will roll over you like some kind of gangrenous tsunami. They've got your number now, and they won't be fooled no matter what you smell like. If you turn and run, they'll take you down. You can build up a bit of a lead at first and even think you're winning, but a hungry can keep up that same loping run pretty much forever. He's never going to stop. He's never going to slow down, and over the distance, he will take you. So you fight. Broad sweeps, below the waist, full automatic. Bust their legs and they've got to drag themselves on their hands to get to you. Changes the odds a little. And if you can get yourself into a narrow place where they can only come at you one or two at a time, that helps too. But you would not believe how much damage those fuckers will take and still keep moving. And some days you'll stir up a different kind of opposition. Junkers. survivalist assholes who refused to come into Beacon when their call went out, preferring to live off the land and take their chances. Most of the junkers stay well away from the cities, like any sane person would, but their raiding parties still tend to see any built-up area for 50 miles around their camp as their very own preserve and property. So when a Beacon grab-bagger patrol meets a troop of junker scavengers, the fur is going to fly every time. It was a junker who gave Sergeant Parks his scar, which isn't romantic and understated like a duelling scar, but a horrific, pucker-edged trench that crosses his face like a bend sinister on an old coat of arms. Parks tends to gauge the mettle of a new recruit by how long they can look him in the eye first time around, before that monstrous thing makes them take a desperate, abiding interest in their own boots. But what makes all the aggravation of grab-bagging worthwhile is the stuff that's still sitting around in all those houses and all those offices waiting to be taken. Old tech. Computers and machine tools and comms hardware that hasn't been touched since the breakdown. Stuff you can't even make anymore. They've got people back at Beacon, tech people, who know exactly how this stuff works, but the knowledge isn't any good without the infrastructure. It's like there used to be a whole factory for every frigging circuit board and every frigging piece of plastic. And the people who used to work in those factories are the ones who right now are so eager to chew their way through your Kevlar to the tender parts underneath. So that old stuff is literally priceless. Parks gets that. They're trying to find a way to remake the world 20 years after it fell apart, and the goodies that the grab bag patrols bring home are, well, they're a rope bridge over a bottomless canyon. They're the only way of getting from this besieged here to a there, where everything is back in good order. But he feels like they lost their way somewhere. When they found the first of the weird kids, and some grunt who'd obviously never heard about curiosity and the cat called in a fucking observation report. Nice going, soldier. Because you couldn't keep from observing. The grab baggers suddenly get a whole slew of new orders. Bring us one of those kids. Let's take a good long look at him. Her. It. And the techies looked. And then the scientists looked. And they all got the itch to kill a few cats too. Hungries with human reactions. Human behaviours. Human-level brain functions. Hungries who can do something besides run and feed. And they're running naked and feral through the streets of the inner cities, right alongside the regular variety. What's the deal? More orders. Requisition a base, a long way from anywhere. Mount a perimeter and stand by. They'd been raiding the ragged hinterlands of Stevenage and Luton, so RAF Henlow seemed to fit the bill. It was more or less intact. It offered plenty of space both above the ground and in reinforced bunkers underneath it, and it had a functional airstrip. They dropped in, and then they dug in, disinfected, decorated, waited. And in due course, Dr. Caldwell came along with her white coat and her bright red lipstick and her microscope, and a letter from Beacon with a whole lot of signatures and authorizations on it. "This is my show now, Sergeant," she said. "I'll take that building over there, and the sheds on either side of it. Go and get me some more of those kids, as many as you can find." Just like that. Like she was ordering fast food, back in the days when there was fast food and you could order it. Looking back on it, that was the point where Parks's life stopped making sense. When he stopped being a grab-bagger, and became a hunter and trapper. It's not like he wasn't good at it. Hey, he was shit hot. He realised right out of the gate that you could spot the oddballs, the kids who were different, by the way they moved. Hungries toggle between two states. They're frozen in place most of the time, just standing there, like they're never going to move again. Then they smell prey, or hear it, or catch sight of it, and they break into that terrifying dead sprint. No warm-up, no warning. Warp factor 9. But the weird kids move even when they're not hunting, so you can tell them apart. And they react to stuff that isn't food, so you can get their attention with a mirror, say, or the beam of light from a torch or a piece of coloured plastic. Cut them out of the pack. Not that there's a pack exactly, because the hungries always treat other hungries like they're part of the scenery. But get them to come out when they're alone and exposed. Then drop the nets. He and his team took 30 in the space of about 7 months. It wasn't even hard once they'd got into the rhythm of it. Then Caldwell told them to stand down and wait for further orders, said she had enough material to work with. And how messed up is this? Suddenly Parks is in charge of a kindergarten. He finds himself defending a base that isn't doing a damn thing apart from nursemaiding these little hungries. They've got their own rooms, the same pallet beds as the soldiers, weekly feeding, which, if you ever want to eat again yourself, you don't want to see. Even a schoolroom. Why a schoolroom? Because Caldwell wants to know if these spooky little monsters can learn. She wants to see inside their heads. Not just the hardware, she's got her operating table for that side of things, but the squishy stuff too. Like, what are they thinking? Here's what Parks is thinking. The regular hungries are clean compared to these kid-shaped monstrosities. At least you can tell that the regular hungries are animals. They don't say, "Good morning, Sergeant," when you kneecap them. There isn't a whole lot more of that he can choke down, to be honest. The blonde one, Melanie. She's test subject number one for some reason, even though she was about the 11th or 12th one he bagged. She scares the shit out of him and he can't explain why. Or maybe he can and he doesn't like to think about it. Certainly a part of it is that unfailing good little girl smarminess she's got. An animal like that, even if it looks like a human being, should make meaningless sounds or no sounds at all. Hearing it talk just muddies the waters. But Parks is a soldier. He knows how to shut up and do what he's told. In fact, that's his speciality subject. And he gets what Caldwell is doing. These kids, presumably the kids of junker families that got trapped and bitten and infected, seem to have some kind of partial immunity to the hungry pathogen. Oh, they're still flesh eaters. Still react in the same way to the smell of live meat, which is the sign by which ye all shall frigging well know them. But the light inside their heads didn't go out, for some reason. Or not all the way out. They were living like animals when the grab baggers found them, but they rehabilitate really nice, and can walk, and talk, and whistle, and sing, and count up to big numbers, and all the rest of it. Whereas their mummies and daddies are in the wind. If they all got taken and fed on as a family unit, the adults just went the same way as everyone else who gets bitten. They turned into full-on brain-dead monsters. The kids got stuck halfway. So maybe they're the best hope of finding an actual cure. See? Parks is no fool. He knows what's being done here, and he's served that purpose silently and uncomplainingly. He's served it for the best part of 4 years now. Rotation was meant to happen after 18 months. There are other people in the same boat, and it's fair to say that Parks is more worried about them than he is about himself. That's not bleeding heart bullshit. It's just that he knows his own limits better than he knows theirs. There are 28 men and women under his command. He doesn't count Caldwell's people, who mostly don't know what an order is. And with that smaller number, base security needs all of them to be combat fit and ready to respond if a situation develops. Parks has doubts about half his muster at this point. doubts about himself, too. Insofar as he's a non-commissioned officer, effectively acting as a field commander for a unit maintaining a fixed post with civilian liaison. The minimum rank for that billet, if you go by regs, is lieutenant. Parks has his own scripture, which doesn't meet regs at many points. But he knows when his centre of gravity is compromised. And just recently, that's how he feels more days than not. That's how he feels today, when he takes Gallagher's report. Gallagher, K, Private, 1097, 24th July, 1736. In the course of a routine clearance sweep of the woodland northwest of base, I was involved in an incident which transpired as follows immediately below. I was bait. Devaney was pacing me with the heavy auto, and Barlow and Tapp were clean-up. We verified a large group of Hungries stationary in the Hitchin Road, close to the Airman roundabout. They were skin and bone, mostly, but none of them looked too far gone to be a threat. We set up in the wood, as per operational parameters, and Devaney dropped me off at the roundabout. On Lance Bombardier Tapp's orders, I was not wearing E-blocker. I proceeded to go upwind of the Hungries and waited until they clocked me. Whereupon, having clocked me, they pursued me for several hundred yards, off the road and into the woodland, where I proceeded to... Jesus wept, Parks says, putting the report down on his desk. You proceeded to proceed? Just tell me what happened, Gallagher. Save this bollocks for your autobiography. Gallagher blushes to the roots of his red hair. His freckles disappear in the general incandescence. On anyone else, that blazing face would mean a consciousness of having screwed up. But there's a long list of things that would make Gallagher blush like a schoolgirl, including, for example, a dirty joke, any exertion more taxing than a parade march, or a single sip of bootleg gin. Not that you tend to see this soldier drinking all that often. He's as skittish around alcohol as if the army he signed up with was the one that offers you salvation. Parks extends the benefit of the doubt a little bit further and a little bit thinner. Sir, Gallagher says, the Hungries were right up my arse. I mean, they were close enough so I could smell them. You know that sour stink they get when the grey threads start showing through their skin? It was strong enough so my eyes were watering. Thready ones don't normally get this far out from the cities, Parks muses, not liking the news. No, sir. But I'm telling you, this bunch was ripe. A couple of them had their faces all fallen in. Clothes had mostly rotted off them. One of them had lost an arm. Don't know whether it had been eaten off of him, back when he first got infected, or if it had fallen off since, but, yeah, these weren't newbies. Anyway, I was running back towards where Tapp and Barlow were set up, behind that big stand of beech trees. There's a hedgerow there and it's pretty solid. You've got to pick your spot. Go through it where it's thin enough not to slow you down too much. And you can't see what you're running into, obviously. Gallagher hesitates, seeming to wince slightly. His memories have hit a barrier a lot more solid than that hedge. What did you run into? Parks prompts. Three blokes. Junkers. They were just walking along on the far side of the hedge, where they couldn't be seen from the road. There are blackberry bushes all along that stretch, so maybe they were picking fruit or something. Except that one of the three, boss man, I reckoned, on account of his kit, he had a pair of binoculars. And all three of them were armed. Boss man's got a handgun. The other two have got machetes. I broke out of the hedge about 50 yards away, heading right at them. Gallagher shakes his head in unhappy wonder. I shouted at them to run, but they didn't take any notice. The bloke with the gun drew down on me, and he was this close to blowing my brains out. Then the Hungries burst through the hedge right behind me, and he sort of lost his concentration. But the three of them were still blocking my way, and this nutcase still had his gun pointing right at me. So I barged him. It's not like there was anywhere else to go. He got one shot off, but he managed to miss me. Don't know how at that range. Then I hit him full on with my shoulder and kept right on going. The soldier stops again. Parks waits, letting him get it out in his own words. It's clear that this whole thing has freaked him out badly, and it's part of Parks's job, sometimes, to take confession. Gallagher is one of the greenest of the buck privates. If he was born at all when the breakdown came, he was still sucking on his mother's tit. You've got to make allowances for that. 10 seconds later, I'm back in the trees again, Gallagher says. I looked over my shoulder and didn't see anything. But I heard a scream. One of the junkers, obviously. And he went on screaming for a hell of a long time. I stopped. I was thinking about going back, but then the hungries popped up right behind me and I had to get going again. Gallagher shrugs. We completed the mission. Tapp and Barlow had set the traps up right on the finish line. Hungries ran into them, got themselves stuck in the barbed wire, and after that it was just clean up. Petrol or lime? Parks asks. He can't keep from asking, because he's told Nielsen no more petrol for routine bake-offs, but he knows for a fact that the quartermaster is still signing off on 10-gallon drums. Lime, sir? Gallagher is reproachful. There's a pit by the road that we dug out back in April. We didn't even half fill it yet. We rolled them in and shoveled 3 bags in on top of them, so they should render down nicely so long as it doesn't rain. This purely operational stuff perks Gallagher up a little, but he becomes somber again as he gets back to his own story. After we were done, we went back to the hedge. The boss man and one of the other two were lying there on the ground, right where I'd seen them before. They were really badly chewed up, but they were still twitching. Then the boss man opened his eyes, and I verified. Gallagher catches himself slipping back into report speak, stops, and starts again. He was crying blood, the way they do sometimes when the rot's just getting into them. It was obvious they were both infected. Parks is impassive. He saw that punchline coming. Did you finish them off? He asks, the bluntness deliberate. Call a spade a spade. Make Gallagher see that it's all just business as usual. It won't help him now, but it might take the edge off later. Barley, Private Barlow, decapitated them both with the second bloke's machete. Mask and gloves on? Yes, sir. And you retrieved their kit? Yes, sir. Handgun is well maintained, and there were 40 rounds of ammo in one of the packs. Binoculars are a bit cacked, to be honest, but the boss man had a walkie-talkie too. Nielsen thinks it might work with our long-range sets. Parks nods approval. You handled a tricky situation really well, he tells Gallagher, and he means it. If you'd frozen when you came through that hedge, the civilians would still have died, and most likely they'd have held you up long enough to kill you too. This is a better outcome all round. Gallagher says nothing. Think about it, Parks persists. These junkers were less than a mile away from our perimeter, armed and tooled up for surveillance. Whatever they were doing, they weren't just out taking the air. I know you feel like shit right now, Private, but what happened to them isn't down to you, even if they were lily white. Junkers choose to live outside the fences, so they take what comes with that. Go and get drunk. Maybe pick a fight with somebody or get yourself laid. Burn it off. But do not waste a bastard second of my time or yours with feeling guilty about this bullshit. Drop a penny in the poor box. Move along. Gallagher comes to attention, seeing the dismiss looming. Now. Dismiss. Yes, sir. The private rips off a smart salute. Mostly they don't bother these days, but it's his way of saying thanks. Truth is, Gallagher may be green, but he's far from the worst of an indifferent to sod-awful bunch of soldiers, and Parks can't afford to have him join the walking wounded. If the lad had killed the Junkers himself, gutted them and made balloon animals out of their colons, Parks would still have done his best to put a positive spin on it. His own people are his priority here, first and last. But somewhere in the stack, he's also thinking this. Junkers. On his doorstep. Like he didn't have enough to bloody worry about. Chapter 13. The week goes by, slow and inexorable. 3 Mr. Whittaker days in a row reduce the class to unaccustomed lethargy. Whether by accident or design, Sergeant stays away from Melanie. She hears his voice yelling transit in the mornings, but he's never visible when she's taken out from her cell, or when she's brought back to it. Each time she feels a surge of anticipation. She's ready to fight him again and declare her hate for him and defy him to hurt her some more. But he doesn't come into her line of sight, and she has to swallow all those feelings back into herself the way a rat or a rabbit will sometimes reabsorb into its womb a litter of young that it can't safely give birth to. Friday is a Miss Justineau day. Normally this would be a cause of intense and uncomplicated joy. This time, Melanie is afraid as well as excited. She almost ate Miss Justineau. What if Miss Justineau is angry about that and doesn't like her anymore? The start of the lesson does little to reassure her. Miss J has come back unhappy and preoccupied, folded in on herself so that her emotions are impossible to read. She says good morning to the class as a whole, not to each individual boy and girl. She makes no eye contact. She tests the children with short answer and multiple choice questions for most of the day. Then she sits at her desk and marks their answers, writing the test scores down in a big notebook while the class works on sums. Melanie isn't thinking much about the sums, which she finishes in a few minutes. They're just easy calculus, most of them with single variables. Her attention is focused on Miss Justineau, and to her horror, she sees that Miss Justineau is crying silently as she works. Melanie searches her mind frantically for something to say, something that might comfort Miss J, or at least distract her from her sorrows. If it's the marking that's making her sad, they can switch to a different activity that's easier and more fun. "Can we have stories, Miss Justineau?" she asks. Miss Justineau doesn't seem to have heard. She goes on tallying up the test scores. Some of the other kids sigh or tut or fidget. They can see that Miss Justineau is sad, and they clearly think that Melanie shouldn't be bothering her with selfish demands. Melanie sticks to her guns. She knows the class can make Miss J happy again if only she'll talk to them. Her own happiest times have always been here, like this, so how can they not be Miss Justineau's happiest times too? She tries again. "Can we have myths of ancient Greece, Miss Justineau?" she asks louder. This time Miss J hears. She looks up and shakes her head. "Not today, Melanie," she says, and her voice is as sad as her face. For a few moments she just stares out at the class, almost like she's surprised to see them there. "I have to finish these assessments," she says. But she doesn't go back to the notebook. She keeps looking at the class. There's a kind of a frown on her face. It's like she's the one who's doing hard sums, not them, and she's reached one that she just can't work out. "Who the hell am I kidding?" she asks really quietly. She tears up the tests, which is surprising, but the kids don't really mind, because who cares about test results? Only Kenny and Andrew, when they're trying to outscore each other, which is really lame and stupid, because Melanie is the best in the class, and Zoe is the second best, so the boys are only fighting for third place. Then Miss J tears up the notebook. She rips the pages out of "Who Cares About Test Results?" Only Kenny and Andrew, when they're trying to outscore each other, which is really lame and stupid, because Melanie is the best in the class, and Zoe is the second best, so the boys are only fighting for third place. Then Miss J tears up the notebook. She rips the pages out a few at a time and shreds them with her hands until they're too small to tear any more. She drops the pieces into the waste paper basket, only they're too small and light to fall straight. They turn in the air, spread out, make a mess on the floor all around it. Miss Justineau doesn't mind. She starts to throw the pieces up in the air, instead of just dropping them so they spread out even further. She's not happy, exactly, but she's stopped crying. It's a good sign. "You want stories?" she asks the class. They all do. Miss Justineau gets the Greek myths book out of the book corner and brings it to the front. She reads them the story of Actaeon, which is scary, and Theseus, and the Minotaur, which is even scarier. At Melanie's request, she winds up with Pandora again, even though they all know it. It's a good way to finish off the day. When Sergeant's people come, Miss Justineau doesn't look at them. She sits on the corner of the teacher's desk, turning the Greek myths book over and over in her hands. "Goodbye, Miss Justineau," Melanie says. "See you soon, I hope." Miss Justineau looks up. It seems as though she's about to say something, but there's a bump right then as someone, one of Sergeant's people, gets hold of Melanie's chair from behind and takes the brakes off. The chair starts to turn. "I need this one for a moment," Miss Justineau says. Melanie can't see her anymore because she's been turned mostly away, but Miss Justineau's voice is loud, like she's very close by. "Okay." The soldier sounds bored, like it's all the same to him. He moves on to Gary's chair. "Good night, Melanie," Miss Justineau says. But she doesn't go away. She leans down over Melanie, her shadow falling on the arms of the chair and on Melanie's hands. Melanie feels something hard and angular being shoved down between her back and the back of the chair. "Enjoy," Miss Justineau murmurs, "but keep it to yourself." Melanie leans back as hard as she can, squaring her shoulders against the chair's bare metal plates. The something is wedged against the small of her back, completely out of sight. She has no idea what it could be, but it's something that came from Miss Justineau's hand. Something Miss Justineau has given to her, and only her. She stays in that position all the way back to her cell, and all through her straps being untied. She doesn't move a muscle. She keeps her gaze fixed on the floor, not trusting herself to meet the eyes of Sergeant's people without giving the secret away. Only when they've gone, and the bolts have shot closed on the cell door, does she reach behind her back and slide out the foreign object that's been lodged there, registering first the solid weight of it, then the rectangular shape, and finally the words on the cover. "Tales the Muses Told, Greek Myths, by Roger Lansling Green." Melanie makes a strangled sound. She can't help it, even though it might bring Sergeant's people back into the cell to find out what she's doing. A book. A book of her own. And this book. She runs her hands over the cover, riffles the pages, turns the book in her hand to look at it from every angle. She smells the book. That turns out to be a mistake, because the book smells of Miss Justineau. On top, strongest, the chemical smell from her fingers, as bitter and horrible as always. But underneath, a little, and on the inside pages a lot, the warm and human smell of Miss Justineau herself. The feeling. The bullying. Screaming hunger goes on for a long time. But it's not nearly as strong as it was when Melanie was smelling Miss J herself, right up close, with no chemical spray at all.
still scary. A rebellion of her body against her mind, as though she's Pandora wanting to open the box, and it doesn't matter how many times she's been told not to, she's just been built so she has to, and she can't make herself stop. But finally Melanie gets used to the smell, the way the children in the shower on Sunday get used to the smell of the chemicals. It doesn't go away exactly, but it doesn't torment her in quite the same way. It becomes kind of invisible, just because it doesn't change. The hunger gets less and less, and when it's all gone, Melanie is still there. The book is still there too. Melanie reads it until daybreak, and even when she stumbles over the words or has to guess at what they mean, she's in another world. She will think of that later, only a day later, after the world she knows has gone away. Chapter 14. Monday has come and gone, and the list that Dr. Caldwell requested has not been forthcoming. Justinu has not spoken to her or sent a memo. She has not explained the delay or requested additional time. Clearly, Caldwell thinks, her initial assessment was correct. Justinu's emotional identification with the subjects is interfering with the proper performance of her duties. And, since her duties are owed to Caldwell, are factored into Caldwell's clinical plans, Caldwell has to take that dereliction seriously. She calls up her own database on the test subjects. Where to start? She's looking for reasons why Ophiocordyceps has shown such unlikely mercy in this tiny handful of cases. Most people infected with the pathogen experience its full effect almost instantaneously. Within minutes, or hours at most, sentience and self-awareness shut down permanently and irrevocably. This happens even before the threads of the fungus penetrate the tissue of the brain. Its secretions, mimicking the brain's own neurotransmitters, do most of the dirty work. Tiny chemical wrecking balls, pounding away at the edifice of self until it cracks and crumbles, falls apart. What's left is a clockwork toy that only moves when Cordyceps turns the key. These children were infected years ago, and they can still think and talk, even learn. And their brains are mostly in a reasonably sound condition. Mycelial threads are widely dispersed through the nerve tissue, but they don't seem able to feed on it. There's something in the children's body chemistry which is retarding both the spread of the fungus and the virulence of its effects. Partial immunity. If she could find the reason why, Caldwell would be halfway, at least halfway, to a full cure. When she thinks of it like that, the decision is made for her. She needs to start with the child who shows least impairment of all, the child who, despite having as high a concentration of fungal matter in her blood and tissue as any of the others, and more than most, somehow retains a genius-level IQ. She needs to start with Melanie. Chapter 15. Sergeant Parks gets his orders, and he's about to pass them down the line. But really, there's no reason for him not to do this himself. He's doubled perimeter sweeps since he heard Gallagher's tale of woe, afraid that the Junkers might have some incursion in mind, so his people are weary and wired. A bad combination. There's half an hour to go before the daily circus gets underway. As duty officer, he signs out the keys from the secure cupboard. Then he countersigns as base commander. He takes the thick ring off its hook and walks on over to the block, where his ears are assaulted by the hyperactive bombast of the 1812 overture. He turns the rubbish off. It was Caldwell's idea to play music to the abortions when they're in their cells, out of a vaguely benign impulse. Music soothing the savage breast or some such bullshit. But they were limited to the music they could find, and a lot of it didn't fall into the soothing category.
In the silence made louder by contrast, Parks walks along the corridor to Melanie's cell. She's looking out through the grill. He waves her away from it. "Transit," he tells her. "Go sit in your chair. Now." She does as she's told, and he unlocks the door. Standing orders call for at least 2 people to be present when the kids are strapped into their chairs, or let out of them. But Parks is confident that he can do it by himself. His hand is on the stock of his pistol, but he doesn't draw it. He's assuming that the habit of countless mornings will kick in automatically. The kid is staring at him with those big, almost lidless eyes. Flecks of grey in the baby blue reminding him of what she is, in case he was ever disposed to let that slip his mind.
"Good morning, Sergeant," she says.
"Keep your hands on those armrests," he tells her. He doesn't need to say it. She's not moving, except for her eyes, tracking him as he straps up her right hand, then her left.
"It's early," Melanie says,
"and you're on your own."
"You're going to the lab. Dr. Caldwell wants to see you." The kid goes very quiet for a moment or two. He's working on her legs now.
"Like Liam and Marcia," she says at last.
"Yeah, like them."
"They didn't come back."
There's a tremor in the kid's voice now. Parks finishes with the legs, doesn't answer. It's not the sort of thing that seems to need an answer. He straightens up again and those big blue eyes fix him to the spot.
"Will I come back?"
Melanie asks. Parks shrugs. "Not my decision. Ask Dr. Caldwell." He goes around behind the chair and finds the neck strap. This is the part where you've got to watch your step. Easy to get your hand in reach of those teeth if you let your guard down. Parks doesn't.
"I want to see Miss Justineau," Melanie says.
"Tell Dr. Caldwell that."
"Please, Sergeant."
She twists her head at the worst possible moment, and he's forced to pull his hand away sharply, out of reach, dropping the strap, which is only half threaded through.
"Face front," he raps. "Don't move your head. You know not to do that."
The kid faces front.
"I'm sorry," she says meekly.
"Well, don't do it again."
"Please, Sergeant," she mumbles. "I want to see her before I go. So she knows where I am. Can we wait? Until she comes?"
"No," Park says, tightening the neck strap. "We can't." The kid's secured now and he's able to relax. He turns the chair, aims it at the door.
"Please, Eddie,"
Melanie says quickly. Sheer surprise makes him stop. It's like a door just slammed inside his chest.
"What? What did you say?"
"Please, Eddie. Sergeant Parks, let me talk to her."
The little monster found out his name somehow. She's sneaking up inside his guard, waving his name like a white flag. "Mean you no harm." It's like if one of those paintings that looks like a real door in a real wall opened right in front of you and a bogeyman leered out of it. Or like you turn over a stone and see the things crawling there and one of them waves at you and says, "Hi, Eddie." He can't help himself. He reaches down and grips her throat, which is just as big an offence against regulations as Justineau's stroking her like a fucking pet. "Don't ever do that," he says between his bared teeth. "Don't ever use my name again." The kid doesn't answer. He realises how hard he's pressing on her windpipe. She probably can't answer. He takes his hand away. It's shaking badly, and puts it back where it belongs, on the handle of the wheelchair. "We're going to Dr. Caldwell now," Parks says. "You got any questions, you save them up for her. I don't want to hear another peep out of you." And he doesn't. Chapter 16. But that's partly because the next thing he does is to wheel the chair out through the steel door and, backwards all the way, bump, 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 up the stairs beyond. For Melanie, this is like sailing over the edge of the world. The steel door has marked the furthest horizon of her experience for as long as she can remember. She knows she must have come in through here, sometime in the distant past, but that feels like a story from a really old book, written in a language that nobody can speak anymore. This feels more like that passage in the Bible that Dr. Selkirk read to them once, where God makes the world. Not Zeus, but the other God. The steps. The vertical space they're climbing through, like the corridor but laid on its end so it points upwards. The smell of the space, as they get higher and higher, and the chemical disinfectant smell of the cells starts to fade. The sounds from outside, coming from above them through a door that isn't quite closed. The air. And the light. A sergeant pushes the door open with his backside and drags her out into the day. Total overload. Because the air is warm and it's breathing, moving against Melanie's skin like something that's alive. And the light is so intense, it's like someone dipped the world into a barrel of oil and set it alight. She's lived in Plato's cave, staring at the shadows on the wall. Now she's been turned around to face the fire. A sound is forced out of Melanie, a painful exhalation from the centre of her chest, from a dark, damp place that tastes of bitter chemicals and the acetone tang of whiteboard markers. She goes limp. The world pours in through her eyes and her ears, her nose, her tongue, her skin. There's too much of it, and it never stops coming. She's like the drain in the corner of the shower room. She closes her eyes, but the light still hits her eyelids, makes patterns of spangled colour dance inside her brain. She opens them again. She endures, and collates, and begins to understand. They pass buildings made of wood or shiny metal set on concrete foundations. The buildings are all the same shape, rectangular and blocky and mostly the same colour, dark green. Nobody's tried to make them look nice. Their function is what matters. The same is true of the chain-link fence that rises in the distance to a height of 4 metres, completely enclosing all the structures that Melanie can see. It's topped with razor wire, held outwards from the main fence at an angle of about 30 degrees by elbowed concrete pylons. They pass some of Sergeant's people, who watch them go by and sometimes raise their hands to salute Sergeant. But they don't speak to him, and they don't move from where they're standing. They carry rifles at the ready. They watch the fence, and the gates in the fence. Melanie lets these facts run together in her mind. Their possible meanings form spontaneously at the points of confluence. They come to another building, where two of Sergeant's people are on guard. One of the two opens the door for them. The other, a man with red hair, salutes crisply. "You need a guard detail for that one, sir?" he asks.
"If I need anything, Gallagher, I'll ask for it," Sergeant growls.
"Yes, sir." They go inside, and immediately the sound of Sergeant's footsteps changes, gets louder with a hollow reverberation. They're on tiles. Sergeant waits, and Melanie knows what he's waiting for. This is a shower, like the one in the block. The chemical spray starts up, pouring down over the both of them. It takes longer than the shower in the block. The showerheads actually move, sliding down the walls on metal tracks, angling as they descend to spray every inch of their bodies from every direction. Sergeant endures this with his head down, eyes tight shut. Melanie, who's used to the pain and knows her eyes will sting just as much whether they're shut or open, keeps watching. She sees that there are steel shutters at the end of the shower area through which they've just entered. A simple ratchet-based mechanism allows them to be raised or lowered by the turning of a handle.